Pressure, baby, pressure. Well, good, happy new year to you. Happy 2014. Pressure I'm talking about is what happens when the power goes out. And it just happened where I live in my area in Marin County. And the strange thing is we don't have any weather going on. It's usual 55 and cloudy. So don't know what caused it. But the good news is it came back on just a few minutes ago, as did the internet. So I'm not quite fully prepared for today's show, but we'll wing it because I usually do my prep a couple hours before, and that's right when the power went out. So it got me thinking, since I had a dark house, a cold house, and couldn't even make my coffee, about how absolutely, completely dependent we are on our electricity, on energy. And that's really what we talk about every week here on the program. But there's nothing like suddenly losing it. And my cell phone was working, so I was getting texts right and left. And it was pretty widespread for the next couple of towns, so I couldn't even run over to a friend's house to do the show from if we didn't get the electricity back on. So, you know, it really seemed like a good way to start off the new year to talk about the reality of what we're going to do when our power sources either dry up or, you know, bite back, or Mother Nature continues to tell us in so many loud and destructive ways that we best pay attention to what we're doing to the planet and to our resources that we depend on, you know, for vital life of all kinds. So want to welcome Dan Weiss to the program. I think he's been with us before, Dan, Senior Fellow and Director of Climate Strategy Center for the American Progress Center, Center for American Progress, and for the American Progress Action Fund. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too, and thank you for having me.
Happy to have any of you guys on. Thank you for the great work you do there at the Center for American Progress and Climate Progress in particular. And to Joe Rome, say hello and wish him a happy new year. And also happy to say that D.R. Tucker is joining me for the first program of this new year. Hey, D.R.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Well, since I was traveling and I got stuck in the polar vortex, I want to thank you for setting up today's program and for all your great work continuing to troll the internet to get all this great video about the snow trollers, as somebody dubbed them. Those are all the deniosaurs that are coming out there to mock Al Gore, to laugh at all us tree huggers, and to declare global warming null and void and dead and a big hoax anyway.
Yes, it's so sad to see. From a certain perspective, it's morbidly amusing to see the amount of stupid people who can't tell the difference between weather and climate.
Right, and we're going to talk about just that. So, Dan, why don't you jump in? What has it been like for you guys there the last week as all the snow piles up and we hear Sean Hannity once again, as if the last few years hadn't happened, and all the times that we... truth tellers, shouldn't use that term, but those of us who are trying to get the scientific point of view across, you know, goes in one ear and out the other, if it even enters the ear at all. So it's just all one big joke for them, but it's not funny, is it?
No, it isn't. And in fact, it is important to note there's a big difference between weather and climate, just like there's a big difference between a snapshot and a film. You know, weather is what is happening at that moment, like a snapshot, but a film is sort of the long-term conditions. And in the setup report, they did note that across the globe right now, other parts of the world are seeing some extremely or even record-high temperatures, like in Australia, where I believe it's been over 122 degrees there, in Argentina, where they had a number of deaths linked to the heat wave there. And all across the globe, people are experiencing warming. You know, NASA has not gotten in all of the climate and temperature data in from 2013 yet, but the expectation is, according to scientists, that it will go down as the fourth warmest year in recorded history. In addition, we know that this past November was the warmest on record.
Mm. Indeed.
It's interesting just to see, you know, this sort of pattern, this sort of predictable thing that the sort of the right-wing deniers do, which is to, you know, as John Stewart pointed out earlier this week, as soon as the war on Christmas is over, it's time to launch a war on carbon, basically. You were on Fox News a few days earlier speaking to Eric Bolling about this issue, and at one point, Eric Bolling laughed when he pointed out that, you know, the climate scientists have a term for this, what we're experiencing, which is winter. Do these guys ever realize that the joke is on them as they continue to deny basic science, basic physics?
Well, there's two axes to that. First, I believe that they're playing to their audience, which is a vast, sorry, not vast, it is a minority of Americans. Approximately two-thirds of Americans believe that both climate change is real and it's human-induced. The other one-third do not, and they're playing to those who do not. That's their base, that's their audience. Unfortunately, the joke will be on all of us, because they have turned what had been a bipartisan problem that people wanted to solve just a few years ago into one where even believing that climate scientists are legitimate can hurt you if you're a Republican. It, people forget that in 2008, the Republican nominee for president, John McCain, had a very similar plan to reduce carbon pollution as his opponent, then-Senator Obama. And that in 2008, there was an effort to get a bill to the floor of the Senate that would reduce carbon pollution from across the economy. Its lead sponsor was Senator John Warner of Virginia, a conservative from a coal-producing state. And yet now, if you acknowledge that climate science is real, you better not think you're going to run for president or even governor or senator in nearly every Republican Party across the country.
Mm. Let's talk about the connection between this deep freeze, this polar vortex, and climate change. What are scientists saying, Dan?
Well, as I understand it, and I'm not a climate scientist, I can read them, but I'm not one. As I understand it, it is the thinning of the Arctic ice sheets in the North Pole, around the North Pole, that has created sort of a vacuum that makes it more likely that this very blast of cold air is then circulates much more south than it normally would be, which includes over parts of Canada and the United States. Now, interestingly enough, in Washington, where yesterday it was 7 degrees out, by Friday it's going to be in the 50s. Mm-hmm. So this polar vortex that people are talking about is going to be a very temporary phenomenon, and you know, we're going to return to having warmer than normal temperatures.
And we are going to have a scientist on from Union of Concerned Scientists next week. We just didn't have room for them today, but looking forward to asking them, you know, more specific questions. But just as far as your general understanding, mine, and it could be wrong, is that when we see climate change, we are going to see extreme weather, and that even though no one event can be tied to climate change with certainty, is there any truth to the fact that, you know, with all these record-breaking, you know, low temperatures, that could be yet one more extreme, like we've seen record-breaking high temperatures and record drought, record wildfire, you know, wildfires, super destructive wildfires at that, and then all the twisters and tornadoes that are happening in places they shouldn't normally or are so much more, you know, the velocity is so highly increased that people are saying we've never seen anything like this. Isn't this another example of that, or do you not think we can make that connection at this point?
I don't believe that we can make that connection. It's important to note that in the past few years, we've had far more record high temperatures than record low temperatures in the United States. In addition, as you mentioned, we've had record wildfires, record drought, you know, unprecedented storms. You know, 2010 was the all-time record high average global temperature. Last year is going to look like it's going to be like maybe the third highest, sorry, the fourth highest in history. We just had the warmest November. And so we're breaking all kinds of records, but generally speaking in one direction, which is in warms and not in colds. It's also important to note that every decade has been warmer than the decade before. So the zeros were warmer on average than the 1990s, which were warmer on average than the 1980s, which were warmer on average than the 1970s. Now, when it comes to specific things, the weather events that have been most closely linked to extreme weather, the extreme weather events that have been most closely linked to climate change include drought, heat waves, and significant huge precipitation events, which is exactly what scientists told us would be occurring as climate change proceeded. That in some parts of the U.S. we're going to have more frequent and more severe precipitation events, which means more flooding. And other parts, we're going to have more severe drought, like in the Southwest, where, for example, the city of Las Vegas's water supply could be disrupted if the drought there doesn't end.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the effects that are most closely linked with climate change.
And I know it's the argument.
Now, can I just say one other thing?
Go ahead. Yeah.
One other thing is some climate scientists have compared extreme weather linked to climate change as to a baseball player taking steroids.
Right.
You know that a baseball player taking steroids is going to hit more home runs because they're juiced, but you can't say any individual home run is due to a particular steroid. And so, likewise, we're going to experience more extreme weather, but you can't say that any one particular event has been caused by climate change.
Understood. I just wanted to interject that flooding, I guess, is another one of those question marks because, you know, if climate extremes are showing us opposites, extreme drought, extreme, you know, rainfall in some areas, look at Pakistan, parts of this country that normally don't flood, and you see, you know, everything from extra dry, extra wet, extra hot, maybe extra cold connected to climate change, maybe not, you know, where would the flooding come in because that is extra precipitation?
Well, you know, we're seeing in places, you know, there's something called a 500-year flood, which is a flood that's supposed to happen once every 500 years, and a 100-year flood is a level of flooding that's supposed to happen once every 100 years. We're seeing in places those levels of flooding happening, you know, several times within 4 or 5 years. For example, I believe Memphis has suffered from several floods over the last 5 years that from the Mississippi River that each was supposed to not occur until dozens of years later at that level. You know, so we're seeing more precipitation and flooding. North Dakota, for example, along the Red Rivers had extreme flooding multiple years in a row when that used to not happen in that way. So yes, flooding due to the larger precipitation events is a big there's a big link to climate change.
Dan, I wanted to get your take on an argument that Betsy and I have come up over the years, and it's an argument that's probably been most prominently associated with the former MSNBC host Keith Olbermann. This argument is that the term global warming never should have been used in the scientific community by virtue of the fact that that term itself is something that deniers of the phenomenon would seize upon when there were times of extreme cold temperatures. Olbermann used to argue that, you know, even though global warming does technically define the phenomenon, the term should have always been climate change as it was, or weather disaster, and that the term global warming never should have been introduced. Do you think that that's a valid argument, or do you think that the people who use the term global warming shouldn't really be held responsible for the abuse of that term by deniers?
I guess I would have to be in the latter camp. It's really a semantical question. Climate change does capture the impacts that are likely to occur from a warming atmosphere and warming oceans. You know, some people, I think like Al Gore, coined the phrase climate chaos, which is really what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and even through the 70s, our average global temperature was fairly stable. And we went through a period, you know, there was the drought and the Dust Bowl in the 30s, but we went through a fairly stable climate period. But for the last three decades, global temperature has increased a significant amount each year. And it looks like it's continuing to do so. Obviously, we only have data from 3 years so far in the teens, but it so far looks like that pattern's continuing. So really, the climate chaos is a good way to describe it. Global warming, I think, you know, I don't use that phrase, but I think it does bear some relationship to what's occurring, which is warmer oceans and warmer atmosphere. When we have warmer oceans, we've got more water vapor in the atmosphere. Water vapor in the atmosphere, particularly in the Atlantic, is responsible for more severe precipitation events. If you've got more water in the clouds, thinking of the clouds as a sponge in a way, there's more water that's going to come out. So in that sense, global warming does capture the phenomenon. I think Obermann's point is probably well taken, but I don't think it really matters. Because as you said, the people who do not believe this phenomenon is occurring are not going to believe it regardless of what you call it.
Good point. On a related but separate topic, can we ask you about John Podesta, who
Sure.
is the founder of Center for American Progress and was recently tapped by President Obama to be one of his advisors. And we know where John Podesta sits on the line of scientific reality, very much a believer of climate change. Obviously, you've got the Center for American Progress and Climate Progress right there next to each other. Are you optimistic about the fact that he will be having the president's ear in terms of perhaps Keystone and just other actions that those of us who are quite concerned about climate change or climate chaos are hoping to see before the end of his term?
Well, first, it's important to note that last year the president laid out a very ambitious and important climate action plan that includes three main components. The first is to reduce carbon pollution from power plants and other sources through both using the Clean Air Act as well as investments in renewable electricity as well as energy efficiency. Second, they want to help communities become better prepared to resist or be resilient to extreme weather like we saw the hurricanes of Sandy or the the drought in the Southwest. And third is to work with our other nations to make sure that they reduce their carbon pollution. That plan has been well thought through and well developed. John will play a valuable role in making sure it gets well implemented. That's a very critical role because a plan without having it be well implemented ends up being just great ideas on paper. So I think where John is going to come in is he will make sure that the president's vision will become a reality. When it comes to whether or not the president will approve the Keystone XL pipeline, since John is a longtime opponent of the pipeline and his views are well known, he has indicated that he is not going to participate in the president's decision-making process on that issue.
To your point about Keystone, there was a piece in, I grant you, it's not the most reliable newspaper in the world, but nevertheless, the Washington Times had a piece prior to the new year suggesting that because of various conflicts of interest and various complications involving the State Department review of the Keystone XL pipeline, the final decision might not be made before the conclusion of President Obama's term. Did you think that is a reality, or do you think that Obama will this year once and for all say no to the pipeline?
It's important to note that in this case, the Washington Times is at least a little bit right. There is concerns about the companies that did the work writing the environmental analysis about the impact of the Keystone XL pipeline on our climate and other environmental impacts, that they had done work for some of the same oil companies and pipeline companies that want to build the pipeline. The State Department Inspector General is investigating these charges, and they're due to have a report out sometime this winter. Many people think in February. There will be no decision, I believe, until that happens. So if the Inspector General finds that there was, in fact, a conflict of interest and they need to have an independent contractor do the analysis, they're going to at least have to start part of it over, and that will delay things a lot. I don't know if it will delay it to the end of his term, but it will delay it a lot. If, on the other hand, the Inspector General finds that the conflict of interest was not sufficient enough to require that the entire analysis or part of the analysis be redone, then I believe that there will be a decision made sometime this year. Now, just the other day, Canadian Prime Minister Harper said that he thinks that President Obama has, quote, punted, unquote, on Keystone, which could mean that he believes that the president won't make any decision on this at all. Now, I don't know if someone's going to have to talk to Prime Minister Harper to find out exactly what his definition of punting is. I know that Canadian football, though similar to American football, does have different rules.
But we do know where Stephen Harper sits on the pipeline as well as climate change concerns.
Yes, and Prime Minister Harper continues to insist to the media that this pipeline will be built. Now, if the president decides that the proposal is not in the national interest and does not approve the permit, it's hard to see how that pipeline will get built. But that's for Harper to figure out.
Well, here's a little side note. We were lucky enough to spend a week in beautiful Bermuda off the coast of the eastern coast, and it was a little bit cooler than usual, but that's okay. It was still beautiful, but we did have our flight canceled coming back home through Boston, so we were rerouted a day later through Toronto. So I had a chance to read the Globe, and there was actually several articles that mentioned climate change as a reality. So the press is not ignoring it. The citizens that I've talked to certainly are not ignoring it, but Stephen Harper appears to be just completely out of touch on that issue.
You know, that's an excellent point. Since Harper's been in office, his policy has been to adopt the same climate policies as the United States. And so before the Copenhagen meeting in 2009, a gathering of nations, President Obama established a 2020 goal of reducing our greenhouse gas pollution by 17%. The Canadian government adopted the same goal. Thanks to President Obama's climate action plan, assuming it's well implemented, the United States will meet its 17% reduction 2020 goal. It's very clear right now, absent some significant actions that they have yet to take, that the Canadian government will miss the same goal by a lot. They will end up having about a 5% reduction in their climate pollution by 2020 compared to our 17% reduction, unless the government changes its policies, which there's no indication that they will at this time.
We know that President Obama was quite vocal last year about the need to take action on climate. Did you anticipate that he'll continue to be vocal this year, especially in the upcoming State of the Union address, or do you think there'll be political pressures for him to tone it down because of concern about Democrats in certain parts of the country where climate action might be a bit unpopular? I mentioned that because there was a report a few days ago in Politico about the Democratic Alaska Senator Mark Begich, who's running ads now touting how much he loves drilling and how much he loves fracking. Do you think that there will be some sort of a push on Obama to not be as vocal this year about climate as a midterm year, or do you think there will be a stronger push by climate activists to be even more vocal and to make sure that this is, in fact, a critical issue going into those midterms?
I think that President Obama's contribution to this is going to be, he will continue, I believe, to talk about it during the State of the Union and at other opportunities, but rather than talking about it conceptually as he did during the inaugural address last year and during last year's State of the Union, now he'll talk about progress towards meeting the goal and progress towards implementing his climate action plan. When it comes to Senator Begich was a pro-oil drilling candidate for Senate in 2008, so it's no surprise that he also is a pro-drilling candidate for Senate in 2014. However, he's also a strong believer in the fact that we need to act to reduce the carbon pollution responsible for climate change. You know, the single biggest source of climate pollution in the U.S. right now that is unaddressed is from coal-fired power plants, and I believe that Senator Begich is supportive of those efforts. We're already addressing somewhat climate pollution from oil in that since most oil in this country is used for transportation and the president's going to dramatically increase our fuel economy standards for our motor vehicles and our trucks, we are addressing the carbon pollution from oil and transportation in a way that we haven't yet for power plants.
And just a quick aside, regular listeners may have heard me tell this story before, but I met Mark Basich at Robert Redford had a summit for mayors around the country in Utah a couple years back, probably 4 or 5 years at this point. And Mark Basich famously didn't come to the first one when he was invited, and he did come the second year because he had, I guess, run for re-election and had dug up some old family photos, and it just so happened one of the pictures was of his family in front of a glacier that he suddenly realized was no longer in existence.
Yes.
So he's a believer in climate change, so maybe he thinks...
Well, actually, you know, the climate change impacts in the U.S. are happening everywhere, but one place that's very prominent is in Alaska, where in northern Alaska, the frozen tundra is melting, villages are sinking, and whole villages are going to have to be moved, which is going to cost the federal government tens of millions of dollars. So, you know, climate impacts are very real and obvious in Alaska in ways that they aren't in other parts of the country, like, say, I don't know, Kansas.
Hmm. Okay, we just have a minute left, Dan, so let's close with a new year dawning or upon us with your thoughts on what we should look for. What do you either hope will happen or expect will happen on climate in 2014?
Well, President Obama is going to propose the first ever carbon pollution reduction standards for existing power plants sometime around mid-year. June 1st is when they're due. This is a huge step forward. Then they'll seek public comment. There'll probably be meetings all across the country where people can tell the Environmental Protection Agency what they think about it. At the same time, Republicans are going to continue to try and pass legislation that would block or undermine the president's ability to reduce the carbon pollution responsible for climate change. So I look for those two things to continue on. People would like to follow some of this. They can follow me on Twitter at Dan J. Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, and we're tweeting all the time about climate, clean energy, climate politics, and sometimes music.
Mm. Lord knows we need some relief, right?
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, may 2014 be the year that we bury the dinosaurs, you know, enough with them. You know, I think we should probably just make a policy on this show to not even talk about them anymore. DR, do you think we can take that challenge up?
Sure, absolutely.
I think so. Oh, sorry.
No, no,
you know, it's interesting that it's important to note that polls show about 40% of Americans do not accept the theory of evolution. And so the fact that there's climate deniers, climate science deniers in the U.S. should be of little surprise to anyone.
Hmm. DR, last thoughts?
I was going to say it seems like the intellectual development of some folks it's devolved if they reject evolution. But I do think that, you know, I hope that 2014 will be the year of our country's evolution towards more clean energy and more reduced carbon emissions. And definitely, I definitely encourage people to follow you and the great work of the Center for American Progress.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I think your wish is going to be granted. We're going to reduce our carbon pollution this year, and investments in clean energy are going to continue to grow.
Fabulous. Thanks so much for joining us, Dan. We've been speaking with Daniel Weiss. He is a senior fellow and director of climate strategy at the Center for American Progress. And DR, hope you can stay with us for the second segment. When we come back, we'll be speaking with a writer for USA Today on our favorite topic. This is The Green Front.